Presentation in public of some of our ideas. And to make it even worse, last night on the train, I had what may be a theoretical breakthrough. So I hope this comes through reasonably coherently. First, a couple introductory words about AIDS. There are people in my political group who would find them controversial. But they are for you. You can raise it in the question period. It's caused by a virus, HIV, and has killed tens of millions of people since 1970, roughly. It's likely to kill millions more, perhaps many tens of millions more, perhaps even worse than that. And I want to start by talking about a couple of what I consider to be misconceptions. One of them is about the end of AIDS, which is a current slogan. It's a current strategy that people, including me, are working very hard to implement. And it's a hope. It is based on primarily on the success of treatment as prevention, which means if you give people antiretroviral medicines, their viral loads go down, they're less likely to transmit the virus. And if you can do that with enough people for enough time, you can eliminate in 50 to 75 years local epidemics of HIV. People have done all sorts of math modeling on that and stuff like that. To succeed, though, it's got to keep tens of millions of people who are already infected in treatment, adherent, and successful at reducing the viral load to near zero for the rest of their lives, or at least the rest of their lives in which they are sexually active or have or inject drugs or stuff like that. To liberals and neoliberals like Hillary Clinton, for example, I was as close to her as I am to you when she gave a talk at the AIDS conference in 2012 and talked about all her hopes for the ends of AIDS. It may seem reasonable to hope for that. To any Marxist, it seems like a good hope, but with gigantic obstacles. And I'll just mention two of them. One of them is the chaos from climate change, which is going to create huge migrations and huge economic dislocation, no matter how good we are at this stage at reducing carbon emissions. And secondly, I think everyone in this room understands that capitalism as an economic process is prone to contradictions and crises. So can you keep up during this time the production of the antiretrovirals, the getting to them in some affordable way to the people who need to take them, and enough calm in people's lives that they don't, you know, lose touch with what they're supposed to be doing and therefore develop high viral loads again. On the good side, in the crises in Kenya a couple years ago, they seem to have managed to do that for most of the people. Now, that's one misconception. The other prevalent misconception, which is almost hegemonic in AIDS circles, is that HIV is a result of risk behaviors and thus of poor choices. Many people who are involved in prevention work will say all we need to do is change risk behaviors, and that's got to be our main focus. Now some are saying also get viral loads down or use PrEP to prevent transmission. And if that were true, the extent to which Marxism has much to do with the epidemic would be considerably reduced. And much of my talk, by no means all of it's going to be more detail on what I'm going to go through very quickly right now. It is true that behaviors can pass HIV between two people. That, however, does not let an epidemic happen. An epidemic happens when it transmits from one person and then to a bunch of other people, and it keeps on going, right? And that requires any or some subset of a number of particular kinds of social relationships. Now, these are not the social relationships of production, except maybe the social relationships of reproduction in the sense of babies and stuff like that. But, for example, the imperialism in Central Africa was critical in East Africa in setting up the initial spread of HIV, which I'll talk about in a moment. And the existence of proletarianized men and women in parts of Africa, created in part by imperialism, but you know, many things other than that going on now. Or in places like New York or San Francisco or London or wherever, and also some of the places in Africa, what I call niches of dense injection and sexual networks, so that if I get infected, I'm involved in stuff that can transmit it quickly to other people while I still have my highest viral loads and stuff like that. Racial oppression, and we don't fully understand the dynamics of how that does it, but it's an observable fact that racially and ethnically oppressed people in a number of countries are more likely to be infected than the oppressor race or whatever. And then there's the whole question of gender oppression. Now, we know it's got something to do with it. We don't understand it well. Why don't we understand it well? Chiefly because almost everyone who studies this, you know, HIV from the perspective of gender oppression is looking at it from a behavioral framework rather than the kind of framework I'll be presenting, which is, you know, a Marxist one. Some of them are doing it from a Foucauldian framework, and they get more insights. And some of them are doing it from general sociological insights or anthropological, people like Ida Susser Mahola, who have done some wonderful anthropological work. I don't know if she'd call herself a Marxist or not, but she sure is radical. Now, when I said before that I'd had a new insight that's going to disorganize the talk, I will mention what it is at this point, and probably bring it in as I talk more about content. What I realized last night is that there's a concept I would point to that is probably as important for epidemiology and HIV transmission as commodity is for capital. That's a tentative judgment. It may turn out not to be so good. But it's the concept of the infection event. Because the infection event is a unity of the infected person, the uninfected person, whatever carries stuff between them, and everything that then brought them to that position, which means all the risk networks and social networks and biographical factors, some of which I'll talk about in a minute and stuff. And it also, if you look at it in kind of a Marxist Hegelian sort of way and ask, okay, what are the others to the person who's infected? First of all, there's the infector. And secondly, there's the virus, which then merges with my body and becomes part of my body as we interact over time and struggle with each other. And then there's the whole fact that the social reality out there creates medicines which affect that battle, depending on 100 socio-political economic factors we'll talk about. And that when you follow out that line of argument, you get to the pharmaceutical industry, the organization of medical services, and all those struggles. And from there you go, of course, to capitalism, just as you do if you follow out the other, which is the infector and all that network and what's going on. You also get to capitalism. So in any case, this is the kind of thing that's leading me to have all sorts of ideas since about 7 o'clock last night. Now I want to move to the main meat of the paper as I framed it before I had that idea. First of all, AIDS is in some way a footnote to history. 200 years from now, if there are any people around, probably it's going to be one of those things like the flu epidemic in 1990. People know vaguely about it, no big deal. But we should understand it's part of a history of capitalist epidemics. And I'm just going to talk about two or three of them. First of all, the Colombian pandemic, which, you know, some folks who are into the Brenner thesis might question whether that had anything to do with capitalism, because it happened around 1500. But as somebody who studies the labor relations and transportation industries, like the Teamsters trucking industry, or like, you know, I haven't studied it, but ships going across the high seas in 1500, you know, there's something going on there that's akin to a capitalist process, even if capitalism is not dominant as a system yet. Now, what happened in the Colombian pandemic is very simple. Before that, we had essential isolation of the infective agents in the Western continents and the Eastern continents. The Eastern continents had many more people and much more complicated variety of ecosystems, so there were more complicated series of infectious agents. In the Americas, you know, if you look at the Americas, it's kind of like two bubbles and a little peninsula in between. And there were less. Columbus comes. He brings with him rodents. He brings with him bacteria. He brings with him viruses. Estimated population of the Americas before he arrived was something like 600 million people. It plummeted over the next 100 years, in large part because of the ecosystem attacks by things like rodents and the various plants they brought, and the viruses and bacteria. I mean, measles, for example, smallpox, chicken pox, these things were killers on a scale, you know, that makes Ebola look small scale. It was a world historical event, that epidemic was, because of this, you know. Spain conquered the Aztecs because they were in the middle of a giant epidemic when the Spanish troops got there. And the Spanish troops had immunity to it to some degree. Things like that, if you've ever wondered how these handfuls of Spanish troops could conquer whole vast areas, that's a good part of the reason. Fred Engels wrote his book about the condition of the working class in England. Two or three years after he wrote that book, a big cholera epidemic broke out in London. It was based heavily on the social conditions and total poverty of the working class, but it's also based on the fact of lack of sanitation. And, you know, the whole field of epidemiology looks back at a guy named John Snow, who looked at some maps of where the cases were and said, it's this pump. So they disabled the pump and the epidemic went away. But it's based on the totality of the social relations of the industrial revolution. The third epidemic I want to tell you about, to put it in the context of capitalism. If you're Marxist, you know a lot about the first global imperialist war known as World War I, and the revolutions that followed it. What happened during World War I was, you know, a flu epidemic broke out. Now, to begin with, it was just a flu. You know, we get flu every year, right? Paul Ewald, who's a brilliant guy who studied viral evolution, looked at the micro stuff about what happens to the soldiers who get sick or wounded and how they were treated. They were moved back to hospitals at various distances from the front line. And he looked at it all, and what he figured out was that the mechanism there created evolutionary pressure on the flu virus to become the granddaddy of all flu viruses. So that the social conditions of the world war, based on imperialism, created a pandemic flu that killed tens of millions of people in about a year. Now, one topic, if any of you have students looking for dissertations, or yourselves are students looking for dissertations, something I'd love somebody to write about, is what effect did that epidemic coming in 1918 and 1919 have on the revolutionary wave in Europe, which could have transformed the history of all humanity had it succeeded, but it failed. Hypothesis, speculation, whatever. It'd be a cool dissertation if you're in the right fields. So let me talk now. That's kind of capitalism shapes epidemics. And sometimes epidemics shape capitalism. Now let's talk some more about AIDS. We know a lot about something that used to be very controversial, which is the start of the epidemic in Africa. How do we know this? We know this because at the same time that the AIDS epidemic has been raging, people have been developing something called phylogenetics. And what that is you look at the virus, which mutates quite rapidly, and based on a series of reasonable inferences, you can make things about who infected whom. If you have dates of when the samples were collected, you can put it on a time frame. You can look at potential viruses in other species and see how close they are to it, etc. Now, we're 90% sure that there have been lots of occasions when viruses, something like HIV, spread from other primates to humans, and it didn't have a lot of consequences. So it's a hard virus to become epidemic. You know, I get it, I might spread it to my family, they might spread it to a few neighbors, and then we all die out. Either from AIDS or from old age or from, you know, something eats us or whatever. Now, based on that, we have been able to trace the spread of the virus. Other people have done this. From basically the Cameroons, and you know, there are credible hypotheses and data showing how the labor conditions and trade routes and violence of Belgian colonialism in Cameroons created a context whereby it spread fairly rapidly within it, and then it spread up the river trade routes towards East Africa as part of the rubber trade. And the sex work that went along with the dispossession that imperialism created in terms of that situation. So it then kind of putzed around, you know, killed some people, spread some people. It didn't become totally pandemic till somewhere around probably 1970. Now, we don't fully understand all the dynamics of that. There were a number of wars and civil wars in East Africa at the time, which may have left some of the stages going. There was the basic proletarianization, which led to a lot of women becoming formal or informally, you know, doing sex for commodities. Often age differentiated, so there was younger women with older men, and once this goes for a while, the older men are likely to be infected because it takes 10 years to kill you, and it spreads to the younger women and becomes very widespread. In addition to that, you know, Timberg and Halperin wrote a very good book on this stage, and make the argument that pre-existing cultures around sex and families and all that, some places had polygamous cultures, other places had other kinds of things, and the way in which they respond to the pressures of proletarianization affects whether or not you get concurrent sexual networks, which means, you know, I'm having sex with you and I'm also having sex more or less at the same time with two or three other people in an ongoing relationship, and so are you. And that can, so it can spread it rapidly through a society. And the other thing is the cultures of circumcision. Circumcision cuts down the probability of infection transmitting sexually. So some places had it, some didn't. Cultures got disrupted. Christian missionaries come in as part of the imperialist process, say thou shalt not circumcise. Some places it takes, some places it doesn't. You know, once again, these are things which Marxists are real good at, and Marxism is real good at, looking at the interaction of changes of relations of domination, of production, of what's happening in the working class and the reserve army and culture. You know, that's our strong point. So I'm not going to lay it all out here. I will tell you, Timberg and Halperin do a reasonably good job of it, but they're not Marxists, so they can't put it in that clear a framework. Now, let me talk a minute about the niches in the United States that spread. And I only have 5 minutes. I told you I couldn't do this. I'm just going to take one niche quickly. Shooting galleries in New York. Shooting galleries in New York existed in the late 70s and early 80s at the critical point for spread of the virus. The epidemic in the U.S. began, as far as we can tell, among injectors in New York. And a couple years later, there was an epidemic among gay men in San Francisco. We know that from historical stored bloods, but we don't know much about how any of that happened. We do know that among injectors, the drug war was happening. Syringe access was very limited. They had to worry about being arrested, so they went to some of the empty rooms in buildings that had been burned down as a result of the fiscal crisis in New York in 75 and 76. And that's where they could go in groups to inject. They left their syringes around sometimes. Other people injected with a beautiful environment for spreading the virus, maybe even helping it evolve to become a little bit more infectious. Meanwhile, there was some parallel stuff happening in gay cultures, for very different reasons, based on gay liberation and yet continuing stigmatization pressures and all the rest of it, plus potentially the defeats of the radical movements of the 60s and early 70s, leading to what Martin Levine called the clone culture when he wrote his dissertation. And that also was a niche which let spread happen. So that's kind of the micro stuff of events. I want to talk in my last 3 minutes first about big events. We call them crises, wars, revolutions, transitions. Sometimes they are followed by giant HIV outbreaks. Russia, you know, the former Soviet Union became former Soviet Union. Huge outbreaks of HIV broke out in Russia and in Ukraine. South Africa, the movement defeated apartheid. Huge HIV outbreak broke out. The people in Indonesia got rid of their dictatorship after an economic crisis. Modestly sized epidemic broke out. Greece right now has an epidemic that developed among drug injectors in 2011. Georgios and I and our colleagues think we've got it under control among drug injectors. We don't know if it's spreading beyond that. They already had a gay epidemic. But fascinatingly, for people who understand Marxism and the fact that it's a probabilistic thing to some degree, it didn't break out in the Philippines in spite of all the crises they've been through over the last 30, 40 years. Argentina, in spite of the crises in the 1990s, and then the getting rid of all those presidents by mass action in a couple months. Colombia, in spite of all the civil wars and everything they've been through, although there's worrisome signs of a beginning HIV epidemic among the drug users there. And the Balkans, you know, the epidemics on any large scale didn't happen. To try to understand that, we're trying to develop an understanding based on cultural historical activity theory, which is a basically Marxist, bringing it into academia in a semi-respectable way, and trying to understand it. The last minute?
You.
Struggle. Communities have struggled against HIV spread. Communities have struggled to get the system to give them access to effective medicines, first to develop the medicine and then to make it access available. It's been a fairly successful struggle. There have also, of course, been top-down struggles against the virus led by health departments, pharmaceutical companies, George Bush with PEPFAR, and you name it. If I had the time, and maybe you want to ask me about this during the question thing, you can look at the ideologies of neoliberalism, how they shaped it all into a behavioral focus, the effect of money on NGOs and community groups. I have another new idea, which may be fundamental, about some of the ways in which the struggle has been deeply affected by the dialectics of trying to negate both death from the virus and dignity attacks from the system as a whole in various different ways. And the last point I'll make is that when you think about the way ahead for these struggles, you can look at things like the Outreach Workers Union in Toronto, which is people who are basically social workers, community-based social workers, syringe exchange activists and stuff like that, who have formed a union against the shitty way they're treated by their employers, and to point to ways in which there's a fairly sizable AIDS and public health workforce around the world, and the ways in which we can combine their struggles with the community struggles around HIV, hepatitis C, you name it.
I'm going to call my collaborator, who is in California. So. Hi, Maya. So I'm going to put you on the over so other people can see you.
I was thinking of maybe doing this.
Okay. Whatever you want. You need to do whatever you want, Maya.
Morning, by the way. This is my morning look.
Okay.
It was literally on the figure.
Okay, that's great. Where's my cursor? Sorry, I'm having some problems. Okay. So maybe I can give a little, just because, and we're going to read this collaborative paper and project that we've been working on, that we've just started, that's the emotional labor of sex work, and also particularly looking at it through a feminist material perspective, while at the same time, looking at the actual nature of like social relationships as they develop and continue from transaction to transaction. And so we're sort of talking about this too through the terms of the libidinal economy and abject labor, and what something else that we refer to as disavowed intimacy, which we will define. And so we'll be reading different sections of this, in terms of, but this is a really collaborative paper as well, so we're going to be switching on and off in points. And also this is sort of the beginning of a new project. So there's a lot within this that we are still, you know, developing in ways in which thinking more of how, you know, how the production of particular types of subjectivities within this work, you know, also has a lot of implications in terms of race and class, and particularly, you know, the ways in which the criminalization of sex work is not only beneficial to capital, but it basically then, you know, allows a number of different types of women who are performing within, performing different types of abject labor to basically not radicalize themselves. Did you have anything else to add, Maya?
Oh, I'm right up there. I can't see myself, but this is the second one of these projects I've done on Google Docs. The first one turned into something called the Logic of Gender, and it took 2 years to write that text. From 300 pages, we worked every single week, and we changed each other's stuff back and forth so many times that it went from 300 pages to 30. And I'm hoping that we can do the same thing. We used to call that one our baby. I don't know what we could call this one, but anyways.
Okay. So we're just going to begin. Former sex worker, activist, and journalist Melissa Gira Grand uses a simple equation to signify the labor of performed intimacy and acts of sexual commerce. Referred to as, quote, hooker math, it goes BJ plus DFK minus money equals GFE, which translates as blowjob plus deep French kissing minus money equals the girlfriend experience. GFE refers to a set of sexual and emotional practices usually coded as intimate that a full-service escort will perform for the consumer of the sex act. The exchange is defined by the myriad sexual services performed while highlighting the particular gestures necessary for a woman to be a girlfriend. But what makes the girlfriend a girlfriend? What is the becoming girlfriend of feminized effective labor? For a sex worker performing GFE, the physical protocol of intimacy can be equated with risk. The more she risks her health, her well-being, or her personal privacy, the closer she is to being an authentic girlfriend. This includes performing services such as bareback blowjobs, BBBJ, by performing oral sex without a condom, deep French kissing, and possibly receiving oral sex without any protection either. But what really signifies an escort performs GFA are those services of emotional labor that only become quantifiable in their execution and can include showing up and being present, engaging conversation, flirtation, cuddling after sex, tenderness, expressing one's own sexual desires, massaging, no rushing, no clock watching, using the full hour, lots of eye contact, and ultimately making the client feel that you are with a partner and not a professional. The last detail is the caveat on which the girlfriend experience relies. The call girl you are paying for must pretend that the exact reason she's there does not exist. The entire financial exchange is predicated on her ability to make invisible all of her labor as if it were in fact not labor at all. The consumer of the sexual relation is purchasing services afforded through a libidinal contract of fantasy where desire is momentarily fully reciprocated. Through Gira Grant's hooker math, she evokes this equation somewhat playfully as a means of highlighting the necessity of certain erotic services in order for the GFE to be enacted, along with an existing range of other labors which expand beyond a singular execution. A client can ask an escort to perform a blowjob or anal sex, but a request for tenderness or recognition is not a finite and limitable task. Like the girlfriend, her presence is fetishized as a voluntary, consensual labor of intimacy, a labor of love invoked from, quote, the depth of physical sensation and from emotionally bounded erotic exchange, or what socialist Elizabeth Bernstein refers to as bounded intimacy. Bounded intimacy accounts for the emotional and erotic labor contained within the market transaction. Unfortunately, this concept does not fully examine the sensorial and cognitive residues felt after an intimate encounter. Here, boundedness refers to the limitations made possible with the attachment of a monetary fee and the, quote, significance of which is illustrated by the consequences that ensue when boundaries are violated, end quote. The violations Bernstein addresses are less common, as they focus on situations where the financial contract is broken, such as an escort offering a lower rate for clients they like who never return, often treating the financial exchange as a singular event, even if it is repeated numerous times with the same client. However, the labor of sex work is part of an accumulative material labor process that is not completed in the singularity of a session. What determines the adequacy of an escort's ability to perform GFE, what one might say is the burden of intimacy's promise, is her capacity to build upon each encounter and a call and call effective behaviors from her feminine archive. Intimacy is fulfilled through the capacity of attachment and sustained by the assurance of its repetition. What we hope to demonstrate is the necessity for anyone theorizing GFE to consider the ways in which these types of empathetic gestures are deeply embroiled in the institutions of love, marriage, and family, extending psychically into the unwaged emotional lives of both the sex worker and the client beyond the parameters of a given paid encounter. In this way, the boundaries between work on and off the clock bleed into one another, securing the ongoing reproduction of relationship at the same time that a particular sex worker is reproducing herself outside of the market. That is, in the constitutive economy of libidinal organization indirectly mediated by the market, within those very spaces in which she must also prepare her labor power for future alienation on the market, for future girlfriend labor.
What Bernstein doesn't account for is the crucial fact that escorts are also girlfriends, wives, and mothers when they are off the clock, and similarly, the ways in which male clients who have daughters approximately the same age of the escorts they see conduct their family affairs, as it were, mirroring in important ways the world outside of service as a site of libidinal and phantasmic reproduction, as well as the context in which whatever ideological and material maintenance extends services beyond the formally and informally marketized sex trade. At the same time, this mirroring organizes the shadowed libidinal economy as emotional economy as such, as a hidden sphere of capitalist social economic relations governed by shadow forms of abstract mediation that appear non-economic, concrete, and immediate, but are made distinct and abject insofar as they exist as individuated labors and governed by an, however informal, pricing mechanism. Sex, gender, culture, and economy are intertwined through the circuits of capital, making a simple separation incongruent to the practice of subject formation itself. However, this incongruence is resolved in the split subject herself. This is the central contradiction within each of us, between the commodity we sell, labor power, and us as the same individual who bears our labor power commodity, but must maintain and reproduce it while not at work. The bearer of this commodity, however, is our very selves, the who which we are, who stands in relation to herself at once as both subject and object. Under capitalism, the subject is precisely this contradiction, appearing fetishistically as a fluid individual who moves freely across spheres of quote-unquote work, proper, and quote-unquote life. Internal to this contradiction is the possibility of the girlfriend as an objectified experience in the moment of selling oneself as property. Yet in terms of its use value character, as an experience authentic to life outside work. This is the magic of the girlfriend experience as the alchemy of commodity fetishism. This moment in which a social relation between things, i.e. between labor power as a commodity and that of money, fetishistically appears as material relations, personal and private, between people, and most importantly, between the sex worker and herself as non-worker. That is, as a free individual and a modern quote-unquote human encountering another. But this, by the same token, the social relation of alienation, which is to say the making separable of the self between bearer of labor power and its commodity as personal property, and of the self as one's own property, sold according to one's own quote-unquote desires, gives the prostitutional transaction an offering of wholeness, of authenticity, or naturalness on the register of the biological. In terms of the other's experience, that is, the experience of the provider of girlfriend experience, what comes with her alienation of natural powers is the recognition in an objective form of the fact that her quote-unquote natural affect is anything but. For her, it appears completely and utterly social, estranged, calculated, and exactly for that hour or so, absolutely distinct from her quote-unquote real life and her quote-unquote free desires and chosen volitions. In short, the fullness of her subjectivity made possible by the money relations. This denaturalization of the girlfriend from the product of her labor in the process of alienating that labor, i.e., of providing, quote-unquote, well, experience as commodity, opens up a horizon for objection and refusal for all girlfriends and potential girlfriends, since that experiential work becomes a real abstraction through its mediation, thus returning upon the naturalized sphere of real life a shadow form of the profession, that is, as potentially conscious recognition that her girlfriend activities are in fact unpaid. The girlfriend experience, therefore, becomes, even if it is only a potentiality, labor as such, and likewise the girlfriend as such becomes potentially a latent reserve army of sexual and emotional labor. As unpaid partner to a partner or series of partners over the years, what she learns through the process of loving is like childcare or housework, etc., a skill. The skill of girlfriending as skilled labor. And that may be utilized by herself, of course, on the market, because it is already skilled activity performed in the shadowy sphere of the libidinal economy. This elasticity, the moments of a girlfriend worker across spheres of privacy, join the value economy and the libidinal economy. However, let us not be too spatial in our metaphors, because these two economies overlap. They are synchronous. This behavior of labor is in many ways no different than that of other unpaid reproductive activities, undervalued the moment they become marketized. The devaluation is the intimate disavow. Market mediation, which socially transmogrifies the work of the girlfriend, both through its commensuration with the value form and through the however informal prostitution contract, radically redefines the Marxist understanding of the specific work of the sugar baby. In much of the same manner that the housewife was made socially intelligible in the movements of houseworkers in the 1970s. Like housework, this call for the denaturalization of the essentialized work of girlfriends today, extending perhaps even to boyfriends and daughters, that's me, I added that, can be rethought as the place of political contestation, whilst at the same time offering leverage to other unpaid sex workers in order to politicize their own experience or make demands for their time and emotional work. It is precisely the fact that the mediation of the market into what was once only naturally assigned, assumed, and unpaid, the disavowal of the underlying money relation becomes essential to the completion of the girlfriend experience. For what the girlfriend is selling is the once naturalized work of love and companionship so often and for so many hours and years donated without payment to past and current partners. In addition, this is the use value of the commodified girlfriend experience. That is to say, the quality of the commodity girlfriendishness is essentially predicated upon the disavowal of market mediation, paradoxically based upon social as opposed to naturalized mediation, i.e., as that which is purchased and purchasable. The fact that the girlfriend experience can be commodified is the precondition of the disavowal and what makes it desirable in actuality. Therefore, contained within the commodification of such experience is a process of renaturalization, a sort of veiling of the value form through disavowal. The result or produced affect is the authenticity necessary to complete a fantasy that the transaction itself inaugurates and enables. It is all transactions, but most importantly within this intimate transaction, in the reproduction of a fantasy, that what must be disavowed is the fact that impersonal, coercive social relations are the basis of quote-unquote free exchange, that is, of authentic experience and quote-unquote real desire. No less, this mediation is a moment within the reproduction of the heterosexual matrix, family, and couple, or girlfriend form. What therefore must be performed above, all else is the fetishization or naturalization of the girlfriend form, which is to say, the commodity form of couple, whereby the girlfriend experience, in its useful and concrete character, is transformed into its dialectical opposite, pure inauthenticity, crass commercial bonding, and above all, a reification of desire. Rather than making a moralist claim to sexuality as an intrinsic sublimated quality, defining the conditions of human nature, or what constitutes the subject's true identity, we are arguing in this paper that girlfriending is an unnatural and historically contingent relation, delimited by categories of oppression and exploitation within the social sphere of production and reproduction, most importantly, which are found both inside and outside of market parameters. Therefore, instead of recognizing only a process of bounded intimacy, we propose the concept of disavowed intimacy, defined as an aspect of affective girlfriend labor, illuminating aspects of the process of objection in the present conjuncture, of a moment in which the wage girlfriend and her work is denaturalized and renaturalized always already in relation to her unwaged sister, whom she in fact also is in her off hours, constituting a field of reproductive activity stretching across conjoined spheres of privacy and economy as a single continuum. At the same time, the performance of emotional authenticity as a skill to be learned in the process of real life girlfriending is honed and reincorporated into the subject through a process of renaturalization. This is in many ways characteristic of affective labor more generally, because what is being sold is a feeling simultaneously consumed in the process of its production, leaving only its traces upon the body of the producer. What affective labor generally, and the girlfriend as worker in particular, produces is not a separate object apart from her own experience. It is only separable in the abstract. It must, in some sense, live on in her memory, or for lack of more precise words, within her. The remainder, the trace of intimacy, is absolutely necessary to the maintenance of herself as girlfriend in the shadowy afterlife of the ongoing girlfriend experience. The resulting trace of intimate experience is at the same time the precondition for the continuing relation. Therefore, it constitutes the reproductive maintenance of her labor power, of a value she must maintain or hopefully increase in order to be sold on the market at a future, and in some case at any time and place.
In addition, the term disavowed intimacy designates the psychological split necessitated and disavowed in both of the subjects implicated in order for the financial transaction to occur. As an amendment to Bernstein's bounded intimacy, it takes into account the multivalency warranted to negotiate many levels of performative attachment, especially as it must signify not only the work performed in the directly market-mediated sphere, but that which goes on in the indirectly market-mediated libidinal economy. As spheres bound to one another, but conceptually distinct, we can see at once how the relationship of transaction within the former is predicated on the continuation of exploitation within the latter, containing and reproducing the unpaid labor necessary for capitalist reproduction and the reproduction of labor power. It is this naturalization of universalized prostitution, here literally and not only figuratively, which under the sign of the girlfriend, the conception of disavowed intimacy can conceptually disclose. It is the renaturalization of sexuality and gender at the same time as it is the making abject of intimate attachment. In the libidinal economy, the currency of exchange is delimited by the intensities of desire held within the threat of death, as death is internal to the structure of labor. For Lyotard, it has always been a matter of work or die, whether or not this possibility was presented as a choice through the condition of double freedom. Women are essentially experts in the field of intimate care, as they are constantly performing unwaged labors of care and attention for their partners. Some escorts who specialize in GFE remark the disavowed intimacy of erasing a life of labor will actually make you a more desirable companion, or in other words, that the less experience you have as a sex worker, the better service you can provide. Quote, it's a career that pays a lot of money and you need no experience. The less experience you have, the more money you can get almost, end quote. If you do not think of the performance as a wage duty or an actual profession, the less you will need to lie to yourself and the client. The labor must be disavowed in order for the fantasy to be produced and is then defined by the mediation of money. In the girlfriend experience, the contract of intimacy is only possible through the disavowal of a financial contract. The latent contradiction here highlights another hidden strata of the cost of this work, which is the realization not that this work has no value, but that it has a very specific value determined by a number of socioeconomic signifiers objectified in the girlfriend through her labor process. Historically, the Wages for Housework movement made apparent this relation by recognizing all the unwaged labor performed in the home, including the social reproduction of the proletariat and the family by feeding, clothing, nurturing, and caring for husbands and children. Although unlike other workers, by entering into the marriage contract, the wife alienates her labor power until the end of her life and can only retake possession of it by severing the relationship through divorce, annulment, or simply leaving. And Maya, I think we, yeah. Okay. Here, instead of Marx's traditional belief that the commodity form hides the true nature of social relations, it is alternatively the social relations of the institution of marriage and the family are what obscured, protected, and made possible through the commodification of abject labor. The reason why this labor doesn't appear social in the libidinal economy is due to the fact it is not market mediated, as its exchange is dependent upon privacy. Objects of commerce cannot circulate among themselves, nor can the relation between two objects suddenly materialize value. The value of this labor only coagulates through exchange among men and thus can be expressed in its exchange value outside of any mediated market. The labor power of the sex worker and the sex worker are one and the same. As, quote, labor power and its bearer are one and the same living person. Labor power is the living labor power capacity of this person, and as such, it cannot be detached from the bearer. Thus, the particularity of labor power poses an ontological question. And this is something brought up that was in the End Notes Logic of Gender article, where the sex worker's condition of being in the world is based upon her condition of being female and a laborer, yet a commodity among other commodities. As observed by End Notes in the Logic of Gender, this confrontation between commodities is simultaneously an encounter between subject and object, enabling an ontological split. Quote, this ontological split exists because labor power is neither a person nor just a commodity, end quote. This seeming contradiction is necessary for the labor of sex work to have value, as the labor power of the sex worker reproduces value precisely because her labor is dissociated from the sphere of value production. Marx noted a distinct enslavement congruent with femaleness as, quote, commodities are things and therefore lack the power to resist man. If they are unwilling, he can use force. In other words, he can take possession of them, end quote. In this situation, at the beginning of chapter 2, The Process of Exchange in volume 1 of Capital, he's explicitly referring to the delicate items of the market, including femmes folles de la cour, or wanton women, women who can't control their bodies and are most likely to fall victim to vice and prostitution. Appropriation and alienation of these commodities was permitted with consent. Is there a frailty inherent to the commodity form, or vulnerability for those who can more easily be placed within a process of objectification? Since the prostitute's libidinal labor power is market inalienable, or that which should not be commodified, the prostitute's value takes on a mystical quality where it is presumed to be both intrinsic to her constituted self, what makes her susceptible to this abject labor, and the sexual difference produced by capitalist social relations, facilitated by exterior conditions. If the prostitutability of any woman were a characteristic believed to be innate to gender, then the fantasy surrounding her enigmatic intimacy would crumble. What is authenticity in the commodified sex act? Or what is authenticity in any emotional or erotic labor performed for a wage? In 18th century Paris, Rousseau began to document how personality was becoming a form of capital, a social relation he deeply bemoaned and saw as a loss of the self, where personhood is sublimated for economic gains. Quote, among so many prejudices and false passions, it is necessary to know how to analyze the human heart and disentangle the true feelings of nature, end quote. Here, legibility is aligned with an innate relationship to the truth of the self. Although once operating within spheres of commercial emotional labor, work must be separated from one's subjectivity since it is not a natural endeavor. Any action performed under the auspice of an unbalanced power dynamic automatically signals some form of slavery since it is involuntary. Thus, the nature of authenticity is highly contradictory, as the sex worker must perform erotic acts of sexual commerce that she would not do otherwise in this situation, particular situation, without compensation. Unless one can develop a physical attraction to the money form, emotional labor needs to produce psychological responses in the body of a prostitute. In an account comparing the work of nannying, prostitution, and nursing from the perspective of sex worker Robin Hussle, she notes, quote, I had no idea if and how I was going to get wet, end quote. Although those concerns quickly passed as she discovered liking sex, meeting new people, while throwing a pair of heels in the mix was often enough to create an almost Pavlovian effect in summoning a desirous response. For the client, bodily signifiers of pleasure hold a certain currency of authenticity, as when coupled with performative affectations, they support a fantasy of reciprocity. After a session at a commercial sex club, a client describes his interpersonal connection as authentic and highly satisfying. Quote, we began with the usual touchy-feely. I could feel she was just soaking, an indication her moans were not faked. The most unusual aspect of this encounter is that Luscious didn't ask for money up front, which is a first for a place like this. I tipped her $60, end quote. Due to Luscious's palpable satisfaction and delay in initially asking for a tribute, she has briefly suspended the artificiality of the encounter in order to engage herself beyond the monetary exchange. Although claiming to be held within the transactional margins of sexual commerce, relational intimacy is often kept in place by precisely testing if the limits of its efficacy could go beyond the purchase. This process of disavowal requires a certain level of elasticity in order to be believable on both ends. Okay, and so we're out of time, and
yep. We're almost done though.
Yeah.
You okay.
Can, I mean, our folks. Yes.
Well, whatever. They can read the book.
Or, do you want us to keep going, or do you have questions?
Read your favorite line, and that will be the last line.
Yeah. Okay. So I can kind of.
Claire Fontaine. The struggle is against a part of ourselves, because we are always partly complicit with the things that oppress us. A movement against ourselves in the bodies we hold, but do not fully keep in intimate refusals of collusion. The struggle force, like the love force, must be protected and regenerated. And to do so will require a total restructuring of all libidinal engagement, to remove the corrupted form of love called romanticism that reinforces the sex class system through eroticism, privatization, and beauty. As Shula Smith Firestone expressed, romanticism develops in proportion to the liberation of women from their biology. Woohoo!
Okay. Okay, so yeah, I guess we'll, and then if people just have questions, because, you know, there's